Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Duff Network, where we reflect on Robbo's most popular work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're here to talk about False Moves. The war for Kennet is kicking off. And we start with False Moves 12A, where we get to understand a bit of the Witch Hunters. And then 12.8, where we get to understand one more of the Witch Hunters, and it's pretty rough.
Yeah, we also get a bit from Raquel, who's like even worse off than I imagined, but we'll get there. Before we do dive into the chapters, though, friendly reminder, when you're listening to this, there is less than 1 week to submit fan art for the fan art contest. Please, if you have anything related to siblings, send it in our way. There's cash prizes, fun stuff. Send them through.
Yeah. You can find out more information on doofmedia.com, and we will do a bit more info at the end of the show, I suppose. Now on to False Moves 12A from the perspective of the Witch Hunters. Witch Hunters? The Witch Hunters.
Oh. Okay, let's get all that out of our system now.
Yeah.
Something I need to get out of my system before we get into this. I'm very offended that this chapter is called 12.A because we already had Cherry Pop's interlude, and that was essentially 12.A.
Yeah, it wasn't 12.A though. It was just 12A, so that's different. That's a different thing.
No, this is being unfair to Cherry Pop because of her inability to spell, and I won't have it.
I think
this is 12.B.
People on the Parahuman subreddit insist that there must be some grand unified theory that explains the naming of interludes in Wild Bow works. And I'm pretty sure Wild Bow did this just to fuck with them. Anyway.
I feel like there's mostly a system, but yeah, I think people definitely grasp onto imagining there's some set pattern, which is just probably unrealistic for a being written as it goes web serial.
Should we get into
this?
It?
This is 12.B. Moving into 12.B.
Oh god, please no, it's gonna get too confusing. Anyway, 12.A starts with a flashback. We're in Clint's head, and he's just not eating his breakfast because he feels a bit sick. And he feels a bit sick because his family have been taken over by body snatching, horrifying construct monsters. And what a fun setup as well. Like,
yeah,
Clint being unwell and us getting these scenes of his mother kind of being worried about him and etc. And he just kind of seems like he's off. And then we get partway through this line, you know, after about, I don't know, 15 paragraphs or something, we get, in the mirror's reflection, though, the hand wasn't human. And that's just the kind of whammy line to give us the, oh shit, okay, so this is what's going on. It's fun stuff.
Yeah, because at this point I was like, okay, so is this just going to be some sort of weird abusive household, like you know, normal human,
like normal in a Wild Boy story.
You're right. The reveal, as we sort of slowly learn more and more about just how fucking stuck and trapped he is, something I found myself doing a lot in this chapter was comparing it to what we learned about Raph in Alpi's interlude in Arc 10, and like the theme coming up from all these Witch Hunter backstories we're getting is that they're just fucking nightmares. Like,
yeah,
you can see how someone like Clint, after what he goes through in this chapter, just comes out the other end as a heartless killing machine. Why wasn't he replaced? Like, were they feeding off this fear? Was my first thought. Turns out they seem to actually kind of like him at some point. Yeah, it's just like it's just a horror thing. There's no attempt to make it out like these are anything but just scary monsters.
I really think this, as the first thing that we get introducing us to the Witch Hunters as well, is a real masterstroke from Wild Bow, and I think we'll talk about that when we get into the next one, because I think the sequencing of these is very interesting. But yeah, you're right, it's just these are just horror story monsters.
Yeah, exactly. Like, something Pale has done everywhere else has always been like trying to justify why others are doing the awful things they're doing, and kind of practitioners to an extent. Like, you know, we had those invaders, what's this way? All the body snatching group. And even they, by the end of it, I was kind of like, shit, they're being terrible, but I can see how they ended up here. I feel like Raph's vision of the past and this one are probably the only two times I really feel like the story has just been like, these are monsters that kill people and they're bad. Like from the witch hunters' perspectives, they're coming. They're very much having experiences of just these are monsters.
I think it's really interesting. Obviously, the humanization of monsters is obviously important to what this story is, right? And so I think the natural reaction to this is like, oh, these creatures that Clint's family gets replaced by are just the monstrous ones, and they probably deserve what they get. Whereas our others are the nice ones. And like, maybe there's an element of truth to these creatures being monstrous, but I think it's just interesting to kind of remember that that's a bit of a mind trap, because our others have also done pretty horrible things and sometimes still do horrible things. We've been in Alpi's head recently, and that's felt pretty rough.
John just killed a guy. That comes up every now and then.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously important at the moment. That John's kind of, a murderer. And yes, there's extenuating circumstances around all of these things, but to the victims, especially innocent with a capital I victims, they're never going to know those extenuating circumstances. Like, for all we know, there is a reason. It would have to be a pretty good reason, but there is a reason why Clint's family have been taken over by these monsters. Maybe they have some extenuating circumstance, but to the witch hunters, there is no distinction that needs to be made there. And because we're in their head as the audience, I think we agree, regardless of the extenuating circumstances, this is pretty rough.
Yeah, well, because there's like the one bit, I think Clint's mum, or, you know, the not mum, has like this sympathetic look, and the way she takes care of him after, there's almost this sense of she does just want this to be normal, which in a way is creepier, but in another way I'm like, they don't seem violent by their nature. The dad came and took his heart out, so maybe a little bit, but
the mum at least
the mum at least gave me the vibes of like, you know, she just wants this to work out.
I mean, they then like try and cover up the damage, and rather than fully have him turn into a not Sasha, which is presumably what they are, then he just kind of sits on the couch and watches TV, and they're like trying to slide back into some semblance of normalcy from the monster's perspective, right? I don't know.
Yeah,
like, I just think it's great. I think it's a great way to set up the witch hunters and give them some strong justifications. It's such a classic Wild Boar trope to introduce what is going to be our group of villains, or, you know, antagonists at the very least, for this next little part of the arc, and then immediately give us an interlude so that Wild Boar can say, well, you know, they also have good reasons for what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, sure, they're violent and crazy, but, like, wouldn't you be?
Yeah, it's worth calling out. I mean, I know this is kind of old news by this point because Wapo has been doing what he's been doing for a long time, but fuck, interludes, you know? They're so good. The idea of just getting really inside the mindset of some of these characters, it's just like, shit, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's very easy, I guess, just because I've been, you know, we've been reading so much Wapo over the last, like, 5 years, especially the two of us. Like, it's easy to forget the time before I read stories with interludes in them and how much they add to stories.
Yeah.
Like, I know we're about 10 years
later.
And this
is a perfect example, right?
Yeah.
As soon as I finished this chapter, I sent it to a friend of mine who has read Pact but has not yet read Pale, just kind of knowing, like, they will love this chapter, and also it'll kind of get them back into Pale. It'll get them to read Pale. And it worked perfectly. They loved it. So, it's just great shit. I just, it's worth calling out.
Yeah.
Clint's not family realize that he knows who they are, and they cut out his heart. Luckily, though, he is saved by some witch hunters showing up. Hooray! The heroes of our story.
I do just want to call out, like, how immediately Clint just kind of turns on his family. Like, the witch hunters come in, they're pointing guns at him, like, they don't really know what's going on, and he just sort of takes one look at them, and he's like, there's one up there, and there's one out the back there. Like, he knows what's happening, and there's just, I don't know whether it has something to do with his current state of missing a heart or whatever, but yeah, he just is instantly kind of like on board with this.
Mm. Yeah, it's, I mean, he's been there for at least a week, right? Like, shit, can you even imagine?
Not at all.
Yeah, this part when he wakes up and the house has been fixed is so unsettling to me.
Yeah.
When he's attacked, I'm like, oh, okay, it's over for this kid. But no, he wakes up and they're trying to desperately go back to some semblance of normalcy and just kind of pave it over. And it's just so horrifying.
Yeah, and I think the writing here is really cool, like, and effective, because it's like there's this real focus on like the smells and the shine of everything that's replaced. Like he's noticing how he's noticing everything that's being replaced and talking about, like, you know, basically noticing how it's a fresh coat of paint and it's all fake. Like the artificialness of it really settles in, and that all kind of leads up to him getting downstairs with a fucking chest full of facial tissues. And his mom's just like, oh, why don't you take a sick day? Like, lie down on the couch and watch some TV.
Yikes. Isn't it wild?
Yeah. And there's like just an emptiness to him in this. And like at first I was like, oh, is that because of like the trauma, or is that because he's missing like his heart, literally?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, in classic Otherverse fashion, the answer is it's both. But like, I guess I just love that again. Like this feels to me like the reason why Wabo decided to open with this Clint backstory, because he could have picked any of these horrible backstories to really zoom in on. The one where the guy literally loses his heart is a very like straightforward metaphor for us to understand. Yeah, like, okay, this took his a part of his humanity, the warmth of humanity, away from him.
Yeah,
and we see that in the prose here, because it's both.
It's great, isn't it? The perfect tie-in of the fact that these witch hunters are both figuratively and literally people who have had their humanity taken from them by monsters. Obviously begging the question of, are they more human or are they more monstrous, and where do they rest? And obviously, I think we'll see next chapter that the answer varies from witch hunter to witch hunter. But just like such a good way of setting up these morally gray areas and making it tie in so nicely and tangibly, I guess, into the themes of the story.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk about here, so there's the part where Elise tries to recruit Clint. Or they don't phrase it like that, but, you know, there's the part...
They don't try to recruit him, yeah.
Well, see, I don't know. I think they kind of do. Like, it's honestly a really half-hearted kind of shitty attempt to make him forget. Like, she's like, oh, the house burnt down. You can tell yourself that, right? Like, honestly, it's no better than when the Kenneteers were doing it with Melissa, except they didn't know what they were doing. I almost get the sense from this and what we see later on as well, I feel like the lighthouse wants people to join them. Like, it is a bit of a pyramid scheme of, like, in a way, they're kind of rooting for you not to forget. And I got the impression, I don't think they tried that hard to make him forget, because they want him. They want people like him. So, like, a 10-year-old who's scarred like this, they kind of want him to fail to forget. And so they like, put in the minimum amount of effort they have to sort of be like, oh, try and forget, I guess. But when, like, the second he decides he isn't going to do that, they were already there with the door waiting.
They're already ready to welcome him. 100%.
Yeah, like, yeah. I don't know. It's just not that they're wrong, but I guess the way that they sort of act as if, you know, oh, we don't want you to enter this world, just rub me a bit the wrong way. Because I'm like, no, I actually think if it was completely their choice, they'd probably take a lot more than they do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder. I mean, it was Elise, who, very young Elise, who clearly wasn't super across the whole spiel. I wonder if, what's her name? Leanne. I wonder if it was a Leanne spiel, we would be thinking something different.
Yeah, I guess we'll get into Leanne a bit more later, but knowing her, I think she might be less inclined to try and recruit as like, not just be better at making people forget, but
yeah,
she also seems like the sort of person who's probably less like, you know, like if it was Raphael or Clint or someone doing this, I feel like they kind of go more overtly out of their way to just try and recruit that person. Or maybe not. They might be like, everyone needs to be super dedicated. They might not think anyone's good enough.
Yeah, I can see that too. We jump ahead to our next vignette, and this time we're in Lisa's head as her team takes down a family man, a nice family guy.
Yeah, just an innocent family, you know, doing their thing. I mean, this is like a fantastic moral dilemma, like, because I think the witch hunters kind of did the right thing, but like, fuck, it's Like, this one's brutal in a very different way to the last one. Like, the last one is just Clint is a victim, there's scary monsters, and he gets saved. This one is like, all of the answers are wrong. There's no right answer to how to handle this situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing I love about this entire chapter is we start with a much clearer black and white, and it just seems to get more and more gray over time, right? First one's clear cut. This one has a villain, I guess. Asher, this is in all senses of words, he's a greedy person. That's his crime, right?
Yeah, but then the thing that really sells him as like just a piece of shit is when they find, like, when he admits what he's working on now is a set of twins.
Yeah.
And it's like, with all this bullshit with the 7,919 people, whatever, like, and you're fucking sitting here making twins? Like, yeah. Like, you have four, which is now, has like, yeah, four children. Like, calm the fuck down.
Exactly. But then, you know, putting Asher aside, there's also like the collateral damage of the lowercase I innocent victims, right? and there's even, I feel, in this part, for part of it, there is hope, like, hey, maybe there will be a way for Asher to get punished and not have all of them suffer. And once we get to the point where we realize what they are, that obviously is not an option anymore. Just grim and gray.
It just feels like there should have been an answer for this, which was like, well, I mean, kind of like Asher proposed, like, get him out of the picture. I'm kind of okay with that part. But like the part where the family gets to live until the numbers are more of a problem. You've got to at least argue for that in my mind. Like, they're victims. They didn't sign up for this. He did this to them. And it's kind of cruel to just kill them. Yeah. There must have been a way to let them live for a little while. And yeah, but the witch hunters don't even entertain that. Like, that to me was like the characterization of these guys, is they're just going to, it's sort of a, like, once they know that you're not on the level, they'll just take you down.
Yeah. I mean, there's no, yeah. Yeah. There's no wiggle room there. And I don't think there should be in this case, but you know, we'll get to that, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. The reappearance of this, 7,919 primeval god beast climate change metaphor thing is really interesting, because it's so perfect for this sort of dilemma where it's like, okay, right now this woman and her kids aren't technically a problem, but they're contributing to a wider problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's like, if they die, apparently that number gets replaced, so it's like, okay, you can kill them when it's caught. Like, I don't know, it feels like killing them on the spot is overly harsh, but then leaving them alive is what a else risk can you do? For everyone. Yeah. Like, oh.
I mean, they aren't the villains here. Asher has set up a scenario where it has to happen, right? And so I think the blame is fair to rest with him.
Yeah, but they're still a problem. Like,
yes.
Like, even if you've killed Asher, like, leaving them alive is contributing to this thing.
Exactly.
Like, that just sucks. Like, I love this because it's such an interesting, different case to how that idea was last used. Like, when we last saw someone who was part of these numbers, they were very much like just kind of a selfish person who you know, had done it or whatever. Whereas now it's kind of like, okay, but what about people who end up like that, but it wasn't them who did it?
Yeah, I don't know. It's morally gray questions, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad I don't have to be the one to answer them.
So the other thing here, we start to really get introduced to, like, all of the witch hunters kind of have one of these, like, powers that aware people can get, and all of them have kind of trained them and honed them, and it's just really cool starting to get an idea of, like, the abilities that we're going to get to see from our new friends in town. Like, we get a bit more of a clarification that Raph had, like, very good eye for detail. We meet Harris later, who smells good, and he is good, but he doesn't know about that part. My favorite though has to be like Elise and her, basically just, she's better when her weapons are impractical and grisly, so she has an excuse to walk around with like bats with nails in them and chainsaws. Like, what a concept.
It's good, isn't it?
Like, again, Wilbo taking a trope from, like, you know, shit like Supernatural and other things with, like, supernatural hunters, and being like, they always carry chainsaws and bats and it's fucking stupid. How can I make it make sense?
It's fun how that stuff all just seems to work out. How Wildbone makes it all work out. It's so nice.
Yeah. And this makes me wonder, like, in the Otherverse, is this the default for humans? Because, like, we've sort of talked about, like, innocence seems to be a bit of a construct of the seal. Like, without the seal, others and humans sort of intermingle. So I don't think there's, like, innocence in the same way that we have it in the story now.
Mm.
So, like, in places without the seal, do most humans or many humans have just, like, a random magical skill like this? Or is it, like, an overcorrection caused by the sort of cracking of the seal around the aware?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, yeah. 'Cause I'm just wondering, in knotted places, like, I guess we're seeing, like, you know, as Pale tears Kennet apart, we're seeing that more people are becoming aware. Like, is it just normal in that instance to expect a bunch of powers to pop up?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I guess the answer is the more a human does a thing, it kind of reinforces that as a part of their, you know, character, so to speak. So it kind of makes sense to me, like, that there is a natural way for these things to emerge, just even in regular life, I suppose.
Yeah, that's just super interesting to me that, I guess, yeah, before the seal or outside the seal, the default is just a lot of people will get supernaturally good abilities.
Mm.
Like, that's a whole set of stories in and of itself.
And thus the Otherverse, I guess.
And I mean, like, that sort of brings to fore, like, the whole concept of, like, I find witch hunters as an idea super interesting because witch hunters are like an accident in a way, right? Like, there were people and there were others, and then the seal introduced practitioners to kind of, and like the judges to sort of balance the two.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, witch hunters have just sort of emerged out of the concept of innocence and, like, naturally, like, they don't seem to be in the seal. It's more like, since practitioners are kind of failing a huge portion of innocent humans, they've sort of sprung up as this, like, you know, people's militia to try and, like, do the job that practitioners are meant to be doing to some degree. They're kind of overcorrecting in some way, but, like, it's so interesting. Like, I can't wait to sort of see, like, how do witch hunters and stuff fit into, like, what Mist is trying to achieve? Or, like these worlds without the seals, what, like, how do aware and witch hunters, like, witch hunters are kind of aware who have set something up for themselves, and, like, what does that look like in the future, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I guess my take on this is, like, the witch hunters feel necessary because the world has become an overly exploitative capitalist nightmare, right?
Yeah.
Like, practitioners especially, but also others, like, have gotten to the stage where they're too exploitative, you know, your Alexanders, your Bristows, and witch hunters need to be the check and balance for that. And in the world that Mist envisions, there might not even be a need for witch hunters. Having said that, though, obviously, this chapter, there's allusions to Bristow's workings with the Lighthouse. Obviously, witch hunters as an organization getting too big for their boots also is a problem. So, I don't know. Nothing should be that big. Everything should be small. Small, just water it all down. We don't need big practitioners taking control of regions.
Yeah, but then you just end up with lots of small, shitty places. Like, you know, like, when, like, you know, big government is bad, but lots of small governments is also bad for some people. Like, you know, you're just concentrating the bad in certain places.
What are you trying to say? There isn't some clean, easy solution that solves every problem, Elliot? Get out of here.
No, I have a big thesis on how to solve world politics. It's available at the $100 donation level. I don't know. It's just, I find, yeah, the concept of witch hunters so interesting because, yeah, they've organically grown up, risen as this kind of, yeah, trying to fill this gap that the seal has left in its current state. But, yeah, you're right, like, with things like teaming with practitioners, the way they don't hear the others out at all, like, they're not really fixing the actual problem. They're kind of treating symptoms in a way, almost. Like, they're not an effective solution. And I wonder how many witch hunters sort of feel that way. Because, like, you know, the issue is, like, someone like Miss, they're trying to fix this and make it so that, like, humans aren't getting hurt as much. I doubt most of these new witch hunters are going to listen to her or hear her out, hear her case.
But I think that's just because they're at a point where they almost intentionally aren't meant to be able to be swayed by fancy words from another or a practitioner. Like,
yeah, yeah.
As if a witch hunter could be swayed by that, that would obviously be a failing in their mission, because practitioners and others are good at that kind of shit.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's kind of what exactly why they're not really fixing the problem that they sprung up to fix. Like, they're kind of fixing it, but they're also, they're like this short-term band-aid that is going to have to change if we want to keep moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we will see an answer to that within these next few chapters, I guess.
Yeah. So, I don't know. They give me the vibes of, like some sort of like violent, you know, people's militia or something that rises up when there's a shitty government. It's just kind of, in a way, harsher and more violent. And it's like, you got rid of some of the corruption, but you've introduced no trial killings and stuff. Like, that's not better. It's a lateral move at best.
I guess we'll have to see. I don't know if Miss will have an answer to this. So anyway, speaking of Miss, we hop into Leanne's head now as the team make their getaway from Ash's house. But on the way back to the lighthouse, they stop by a small little town with a big barrier around it. It's Kennet.
And I mean, this is great. Like, you've been talking about like the transitions between all these segments. Sort of right towards the end here, we meet Leanne, who like is very explicitly sort of set up as the heart of the group. Like, she's the encouragement. She's the one who like asks the questions. Here in Kennet, she explicitly is willing to hear Miss out, because she's like, oh, I don't really have a problem with others. Like, I just don't like people who are selfish and hurting other people.
Mm.
And Miss is sort of like, hey, I'm trying to do something good. And she believes her. And you're just like, oh, Leanne's one of the good ones. And then we sort of get to the end of the chapter and it's like, Leanne's not here. And it's like, fuck.
Mm. Yep. It would have been nice to have Leanne around. Miss did very well here. It clearly has worked. I mean, it's confirmed that it worked next chapter, right?
Yeah, although, like, honestly, I feel like that has more to do with Leanne than Miss, because Miss was her usual, like, suspect as fuck self.
Yeah, true.
Where it's like, who else is here? I'm not going to tell you. What are you trying to do? Don't worry about it.
Mm.
But I promise it's okay. If you knew what I knew, you'd think it's good. It's like, that's a nonsense statement, Miss. Like, yeah, I think Marisica did her a real solid telling her to go for Leanne with this, because not many people would have given the bullshit Miss is throwing out here much attention, I don't think.
Mm. Yeah. You're right. It's more Leanne wanting to keep her family safe than it is Miss doing a great job, I guess.
Yeah. we should touch on like Elise and Leanne. We get their origin story here as well. And I feel like this really sells like the Leanne that we see here that is willing to make that deal with Miss. It makes sense because like, the bad guy in Elise and Leanne's origin story is Leanne's husband. And he was just an innocent who found like an object and it made him evil. And like, yeah, it got to the point where very quickly he fucking banished his wife and his daughter. Like, and like, I guess you can see that like the monster in their backstory was just a person. So of course Leanne kind of must be coming from this perspective of, well, I mean, any of us can be monsters. And that sort of equipped her a bit better than say someone like Clint or Raphael, who like met monsters doing monstrous things. And that's kind of just a connection that's been made in their heads forever. Like Lucy talked about actually on her date with Wallace. I think that was like a bit of a thread in that chapter. That's sort of what the witch hunters are in a way. A lot of them, like Clint and Raphael, they met a bad monster the first time, and to an extent, they now just can't look past that when they meet others.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting pull out that you've got here, like that Leanne and Elisa's story involving just a shitty human, not a practitioner, not another, just somebody that got too much power and was not the right person for it. Yeah, I like that.
And especially because, like, it kind of retroactively made me think, oh, well, no wonder Elise saved bashing Ash's head in for herself, because, like, a selfish dickhead dad, she might have been letting out a bit of steam on that one. I'm not saying we should point her at Brett, but I'm not saying we shouldn't.
I don't know if I can agree. Even Brett, no, I don't know if I can agree to that.
I don't know if we should point her at Brett, but, like, you know, if she finds bread on her own.
She finds bread of her own accord, yeah.
And there's something else going on, and we've got to pick one or the other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm also starting to get a little bit sus of this Samaniego guy. Like, just because, you know, we learn later that, you know, the witch hunters are, it kind of sounds like, human trafficking aware with Bristow.
Mm-hmm.
And this Samaniego guy, like, we keep hearing his name and everyone's like, he's the boss and he's really cool. But, like, I don't know. It's just we constantly hear about this guy and that we don't actually ever see him or, like, hear from him directly. There's some story with this guy. I don't know if it's something Pale's going to talk about or what, but, like, because, you know, with Plex potentially around the corner and this connection to Bristow now, maybe he's going to be involved in that story, but... I just get the feeling there's something up with this guy who everyone is always like, oh, he's the best and he's in charge, and just we don't actually see him. No one questions him. It's weird.
Yeah. The fact that anybody is willing to make bargains with Bristow makes me not trust them.
Exactly. Like, he's, sold his soul to some degree.
Yeah. So finally we jump into the head of the experienced hound dog Gerald Harris in the present day. As the team arrives in Kennet, their initial negotiations with Musa go pretty poorly as Jabba shows up and gives them all the giggles.
I'm going to kind of take this as some more evidence for my theory last week that, like, one of the effects in Kennet, as it's knotting, is that, like, violence is being encouraged karmically, because it's kind of like as soon as they get to the point where their negotiations look like they might go well, Jabba just shows up. And that felt like a little bit to me like a kind of, okay, the universe didn't want this to go through.
Mm.
Like, I feel like we're going to see more and more that negotiation is being discouraged in Kennet.
Do you think that's what it was? I've kind of put it up to Guillemet and Guillemet's manipulations.
Well, he says his stuff didn't go well. So, like, yeah, I mean, it could be. But, you know, again, you know.
We're getting all our stuff.
Yeah, good stuff.
I just think, you know, both could be true. I guess we'll keep seeing how it goes, but I'm becoming more and more convinced that this is part of Kennet now, is as long as it's knotted in the Carmine stuff, negotiations won't go forward. Because it's like the second, I think, Elise is like, oh, we'll just take a bribe, which to me, I was like, oh, well, Muster will take them up on that, no worries. Like, and yeah, it just doesn't. The second I was like, oh, this might go somewhere, just got tanked by Jabba.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, that's what we want, right? I don't want them working together.
Yeah, them together would be bad. It just does feel weird to be like, yes, fight. Like, yeah, there's a very fun bit later on.
That is what we want.
Sorry?
That is what we want, right? We want them to fight.
I know, but it does feel weird being like, yes, get bloody.
Mm.
Like, get violent.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
I also we're obviously in Gerald's head for this last bit. I still say I was kind of immediately a little bit like on board with Gerald. Like, I, this sort of grizzled hunter, I just really liked that perspective. The bit where they drive past Guillemet and he like tries to throat him from the car, and then Guillemet puts it back, he like smells his hand, he's like, I've got the exact quote here. He says, "Fucking fairy. Fucking fuck fuck. I hate the fucking things. Fuck. That's a bad fucking omen. Fuck." And I'm just like, based on everything we've seen about fairy in this story so far, I was like, okay, so Gerald knows what's up.
Yeah. The only appropriate reaction to fae, isn't it?
Yeah, like knowing that you're going up against a fairy, that seems like a good reaction.
Definitely it is. The only reaction is to just swear and hope that you can get through all their shenanigans.
And then there's, like, even a great bit where somebody's like, you're being manipulated. And he's like, I know, but, like, I'm just trying to cut through that by getting there. It's like, but what if that's manipulation? It's like, this is the fucking thing with fairy. Like, you're better off just doing your own thing and just, like, hoping, you know, that doesn't make them angrier at you to draw you in more, I guess. Like, just, you can't beat him.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. What can you do? I guess just, yeah, play your own game, try and ignore him.
Yeah.
I do like that they really stick it to Musa. He's such a piece of shit.
God, doesn't he just drive you nuts in this segment? Like, he's so... There's like four or five things he says where I was just like, oh, you're such an arrogant prick. Like, yeah, like, Wabba's just really good at, like, getting me right back on board with hating the dude. Mm. He's not that fun, smarmy like Alexander was. He's just... He's openly better than you, and I hate it. Like, everyone he's in the conversation with, he doesn't even pretend to not think he's better than them.
The bit where he says, you look young enough to be my illegitimate child. It's just so weird. Yep. He's just such a fucking crazy thing to say. Unless I'm misinterpreting it and Musa actually has a long-lost illegitimate child that he desperately wants to reconnect with. And this is his way of, like, softly testing the waters to his potentially joyful and tearful reunion. But it's probably just him being a fucking weirdo, and it's really unsettling.
Yeah, the illegitimate part of that sentence really feels unnecessary. Yeah. He could have just said child.
Why would you say that?
Like, just saying you look young enough to be my child is a little bit weird, but, like, that's something people...
That's at least a phrase, yeah.
Yeah, adding the illegitimate in there, it's just like, mate, you're just the worst.
Mm.
I do think, though, it would be funny if his illegitimate daughter came into the picture and he took her under his wing, like you said, just to see how Raquel took that would be funny. Mm. Like, can you imagine Raquel's face when Musa's just like, here's my daughter and she's going to become part of the family?
Mm. Yeah. Anywho, that's the end of that chapter. Get a good opportunity to meet the nice witch hunters and get a little bit on side before we see the witch hunter we're going to meet next and really undo all that good work, I guess.
Yeah, she comes across a little bit less sympathetic than some of the ones from this chapter.
Yeah. So yeah, 12.8, we're in Avery's head, and it begins with Avery watching the events of the last chapter with Musa and the witch hunters, you know, duking it out a bit before she hops back over to chat to the rest of the group. They're recapping what they know with Lucy overhearing basically all of it, recapping what we know about the team so far.
Yeah, and I love, like, Guillaume is kind of taking the four, like, because he's the fairy, so he can read people and tell you things about them very quickly. And there's just a really fun dynamic here where, like obviously we've compared, you know, winter or falling to winter as being like becoming an old person and dying a lot in the story. And, like, Guillaume gave me a lot of, like, old person really dragging out the story vibes. Like, you know, that cliche of, like, you know, an older person telling a story and they just cram it with so many unnecessary details. Like, even John at this point is being like, Guillaume, can you get to the fucking point?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, he really loves to drag it out, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I just wonder if that is worse now because he's falling to winter. I wonder if that is a little side effect for him, at least, of going winter, is like his inability to prioritize. It seems to be becoming more and more of a thing.
Mm.
And, like, yeah, as he seems to be getting less effective, like that has sort of kept coming up. It's like his plans aren't working as well. We've seen it a lot in the last few arcs. I wonder how much we should actually trust his reads on some of these people. In particular, I'm thinking of there's one kid, Francis, who the only thing we really know about Francis is that he was involved with fairy stuff. And Guillaume quite explicitly was like, oh, it wouldn't be fairy directly, it would be fairy adjacent.
Mm.
And that's maybe the sort of detail where now I'm like, I don't know if I trust that as much coming from you anymore. Like, I believe that you believe that, but...
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if we're going to get burnt by trusting Guillaume's read on something at some point because he's clearly getting less effective.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that. I wonder if that will happen. It's an interesting prediction for sure.
Especially, like, you know, with him and Marcy having gone head-to-head a lot, and presumably, like, he would be the one trying to play on Marisica's level when she comes back. If he's falling apart, she'll get the upper hand very quickly, and that won't be good for anyone.
Mm. That maybe is when we will see it, is when they, you know, if Marisica comes back, Guillaume goes toe-to-toe with her and just gets completely taken out.
Yeah, because he's sort of been her mentor, so we get that old, you know, the master has become the learner moment.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Should we quickly go through all of the witch hunters? Because at least, like, between... There's a bit of a changing cast in all of the flashbacks from last chapter, and then here, I at least needed to sort of make a list of everyone who's shown up. I don't know how good audio this will make, but I just thought we should kind of run through
everyone who's good here
and what we know.
I was a little... I mean, some of the main people I understand, but there are a few that I was just in one ear and out the other, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's a bit hard because some people were in some of the flashbacks, but they aren't here. Yeah. Like, you know, Raph is obviously one of those.
Yep.
But yeah, okay, so I guess just to sort of run through, obviously we know Elise, she was the one who recruited Clint.
Yep.
She killed Asher with the baseball bat. She's sort of the leader, kind of. Her and Gerald trade that around a bit. But the big read on her we have at the moment is that she is kind of like a nice, normal person in regular circumstances, but when she, like, enters
killing mode. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I think to quote Guillaume, she falls a long way. Like, she seems to be one of those people who can just tuck her humanity behind, like, get it out of the way, compartmentalize her humanity away for a bit, go on a murder spree, and then kind of put it back in place and just deal with that fairly quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Elise is going to be an interesting character. I anticipate that she'll be the one that they really have to convince. So I look forward to having some, you know, dialogue showdowns with her, I suppose.
But there's that interesting wrinkle because it depends what mode she's in. Like, they're going to have to try and get her out of killing mode to have that conversation with her, which, given what Kennet is like these days, easier said than done.
Yeah, exactly.
Then the next witch hunter was obviously Gerald Harris, who's like our older gentleman. He's like in his mid-50s, which is obviously like, fuck what Musa says, that feels impressive for a witch hunter. And he's quite religious. He's the one who constantly has the beats coming up of, like, he doesn't like it when they say the universe did this. He's quite explicit, it was God. And I think in this part of the chapter, Avery compares his look to, like, Amish sort of styling. So yeah, like, that's very interesting. We talked about this a bit with Raph, but, like, just seeing someone overtly religious in this world is fascinating to me. I wonder how he reconciles going around killing monsters with being presumably some flavor of Christian.
I love Harris's sense of smell gimmick. I think that's just very fun.
Yeah, he can go head to head with Snowdrop.
Yeah.
Then we obviously have Clint, the little boy who was being chased by what I think were alchemical others, like Jabba-likes. We forgot to talk about that during his interlude, but I'm pretty sure they were alchemical things. Anyway, he's finally the first proper heartless person in town. Matt was just a poser. This is what heartless is really about.
I think this is really interesting because, like, you've been calling Clint heartless, and I think that's obviously he is to an extent, but also his heart is the source of his, like, strength, his ability, right? Like, the heart is what lets him get out of Jabba's, you know, thing.
Yeah.
Laughing. And so I would characterize it as not, like, heartless, but more like keeping his heart at a distance until he needs to use it, I guess, which I think is important because if the goal is for Avery to eventually break through the heartlessness and monstrousness of these witch hunters, maybe there's a route to do it there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Fill his heart with good vibes and give it back to him.
Yeah.
Either
physically or metaphorically, yeah.
Yeah, the heartless thing's obviously just a dumb pun, especially in this universe where it's like, that's actually a term. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the way he's kind of weaponized his distance from his heart is super fascinating character-wise, and I can't wait to see where it goes. Next on the list, we have Rocky.
This is where we get to the ones that we don't really know much about.
Yeah, we don't know Rocky. She just wears cargo pants with lots of gear in them and a hoodie, which, like, gave me the impression she's got something to hide, like maybe she's covered in scars or something. I think we get the one thing from Leanne where Leanne's like, she's very attractive and knows how to use it. But I think we mostly We mostly see her pretty covered up.
Cute little girl vibes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, but also apparently maybe a bit of a psycho. So yeah, we'll see with her. Then yeah, there's this guy called Renfro who we know literally nothing about. If I had to take a guess, he's probably wearing a red shirt. Francis is the other one. Francis is the guy who he tells Gerald, and then Guillaume confirms it next chapter that he was brought into the world with at least Fae adjacent stuff.
Mm.
And Renfro and Francis, I think of the two, they're very new. They're like newbie witch hunters, which is like, fuck, what a first assignment.
Yeah.
Talk about fucking being thrown in the deep end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I did want to call out, who isn't here, just because that also helped me clarify stuff. So obviously we talked about Leanne is not here, the heart of the group, the person who will listen and negotiate, didn't make it to the place where that's becoming harder to do. And in Elise's part of the interlude, we met this guy called Nelson, who was basically characterized as being a dick. He's not here.
Yeah, it seemed like he wasn't he seemed like he was more on the Cleo side of things, I guess, which is a little... I mean, I'm glad he's not here, I guess.
Yeah, he barely... He hesitated when Elise assigned him the job of killing the children because he thought it was unfair that she didn't have to do it. Like, there was no... I didn't get the impression that he was like, I don't want to kill kids. He was more just like, what are you doing? Like, it was a personal grudge against Elise was the source of his complaint, not a moral problem with shooting kids in the head.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, not sad to see him go, but I did find that surprising because he was such a presence in the previous interlude. I was surprised that he didn't make it to this one.
Mm.
And then the last one, we'll talk about her a lot in a bit, but obviously not technically part of the group, but Cleo Ashire has come to town and we're all worse off for it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to her in a second, I suppose. I guess it's worth calling out. There's a bit where Guillaume mentions that she doesn't fit in with the group. Like, she's an ally and they know her from passing meetings, but she's not really a core part of the group. And I'm just very thankful that those lines are in there because otherwise, you know, any chance of this not ending in bloodshed is out the window immediately, basically.
Yeah. It is good to know that she's not quite on their level. And I wonder if that'll play into turning things around.
Yeah. Yeah, we will have to see. But yeah, so these witch hunters seem very competent, right? Like when we were setting up the idea of the Kenadathas and the witch hunters... the BHI group, the Musses and the witch hunters fighting. I kind of, you know, at the end of that bit where Charles was given up to Ray, that chapter, I was kind of like, okay, so maybe they'll fight and the Kenneteers and Kennedothers can just kind of play damage control and they won't have to get too involved. But it seems pretty quickly to become clear that that's not happening. Like Harris immediately spots the Kenneteers and if not now, then after Cleo regroups with them, they'll all be aware that there's at least three distinct groups here at play and things are a little bit more complex. So I guess Harris said it best. Musa said it best last chapter when he said, oh, this is going to be a shit show, isn't it? yes, it definitely is.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. I feel like the original version of the plan that we kind of bought into being possible was they'll duke it out and Team Kennet will just be on the sidelines cleaning up messes, making sure innocents don't get hurt.
Yeah.
And that idea is already kind of gone. Like,
yeah, it's gone out the window almost immediately, huh?
Like, the witch hunters are clearly going to be a bit gung-ho just going after any set of others and practitioners they can find. So this is just sort of turned into a full-on, like, three-way fight.
Yeah. So yeah, they do a bit more brainstorming and planning and Avery leaves the group to go and try and talk some sense into Raquel. Raquel is too busy trying to climb up her family tree to listen, unfortunately.
Yeah, I also planning there is in,
is in quotes.
Because Zed sort of calls this whole thing out, but it's not really a plan. It's more of an idea.
Mm.
Like the idea is sort of, I don't know, let's just kind of watch, hope it goes our way.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm not saying I have a better idea or a better plan. I'm just saying that, like, you know, someone calling this a plan would, in my mind, be a stretch of the definition of the word plan.
Yeah, I love that Zed's kind of like, So what's the plan? And there's just no answer. Zed is really firing on all cylinders at this part of the chapter.
Yeah.
There's a bit where Avery's like, well, I'm going to go and you know, try and chat to Raquel. And Zed's response is, Raquel, blah, 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 is slippery. Slippery could mean you end up in the witch hunter's way while she runs for it, which is exactly how the interaction goes later. So Zed, 10 points for that. And then there's another bit where Verona says, talking about Nicolette, says, oh, tell her I'll send the file later. And Zed's response is, are you going to send her the file later? I don't want to get gainsaid. And Verona doesn't respond to that, indicating to me that Zed is incredibly aware of what's going on and definitely would have gotten a little gainsaid if he wasn't careful. So again, Zed, you're a fucking champion.
Yeah, you're right. He hasn't actually gotten to do anything yet. And I already have this vibe that he's a real asset at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, that bit with Verona, though, is just such a good proof as to why I wouldn't last 10 minutes as a practitioner. Because, like, the amount of times I'll say stuff like, oh, yeah, I'll do that tomorrow. And then a few hours later, realize that I forgot that tomorrow I have, like, some fucking thing on that means I absolutely cannot do what I just promised to do. Like, Zed's got a really good point here that it's like they're about to basically go to war. Probably not the time to be promising to send shit, like, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it was a funny moment for sure.
Yeah. And then to get back to Raquel, like you mentioned, obviously we have this bit where Avery tries to reach Raquel, and it's just that classic Wobo thing where, like, you know, I think last week I went on a big rant where it was like, I'm worried about Raquel. She's going to be in a really bad spot. In classic Wobo fashion, it turns out she's actually in an even worse spot than I expected, because, like, not only is she still desperately climbing her family's ladder, but, like, she goes on all this extra stuff about how she's lost the Blue Heron Institute as a place where she wasn't constantly under that pressure.
Mm.
Like, that was her escape or her chance to move up and get wins for her. And now that she's surrounded by her family there, that opportunity's gone. Like, she's just... I hadn't considered the fact that, like, her uncle is now the headmaster means that things are even worse for her now. Like, that's intense.
Mm. Yeah, you feel bad for Raquel, but also not that bad. She's kind of being the worst.
yeah, it's like, Raquel's interesting because I, like, particularly she has that one moment where I was just like, oh, hold the phone. The bit where she, like, says to Avery, you and your friends are everything that's wrong with the practice in the modern day. And I was like, excuse fucking you. Like, that coming from a Musa is a real big claim. But what I hate about Raquel is that I can see growing up in her environment, I would probably think the same thing as her. Like, she's very much a product of where she grew up in a lot of ways. And I struggle to hold it against her, even though I think she's exactly wrong and is... Like, it's heartbreaking to see her trying to climb this ladder that is rigged against her and, like, watch her, like, face plant through life trying to do something that she shouldn't be trying to do. But I can't get mad at her because I can see why she's attached to that idea.
Yeah, like, she's getting upset at the people that are stopping her from, that are, like, you know, the straw that's breaking the camel's back, I suppose, against her in this, obviously... prejudiced society, right? Like, she's been set up to fail and being, you know, not given a fair shake, and then she gets upset at the thing that stops her from getting even the meager chance, and it's just like, no, get upset at the system which is fucking you over, not the symptom of it, you know?
Yeah, well, and I mean, the other part of what she's trying to do is she wants to be a muscle. She doesn't want to change the system. She just wants to be on top of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, so that's the other thing. Like, Avery sort of says it. Like, her goals aren't good, but at the same time, it's just like, well, Avery sort of like, she's still a person. And I'm also like, yeah. And I guess if I was, you know, 13 years old and being brought up in that environment, I'd probably be the same. I think a lot of people would. It's going to be a real... monumental effort to try and get her to see a perspective where this isn't the way things should be.
I don't know if we'll get there. I mean, hopefully we will by the end of this little part of the arc, but I don't know.
Yeah, you hope so, but you can't know. The other thing from this section that we should really talk about is Avery thinks a lot about how she's quite explicitly leaning into the familiar bond she has with Snowdrop. And it's like really cool. Like they're sharing, I mean, they're basically telepathic at this point. Like Snowdrop is literally watching her back and they're still able to kind of move around with while looking in opposite directions because they're just that connected. And like she can kind of see when something gets Snowdrop's attention, kind of smell what she's smelling. Like, fuck, that's cool.
Mm, it is good, isn't it? It's an asset in so many ways. The other part of this chapter where it really comes in handy is Avery almost escapes from Cleo using the fact that she has a strong bond with Snowdrop, and it's just like, yeah, it's just like a fun moment. Like not just the the perks, the powers that she gets, but even just the relationship and the role it plays in her life is in and of itself an asset, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah, which of course is like it's why it had to be Avery that got her familiar, right? Because this is like she goes on a whole thing here about how like the thing she really gets fulfillment out of is being a part of a team, and like this ability she has to be in sync with Snowdrop and operate as a single entity like a good team tries to do is just like the ultimate end goal of that. Like you couldn't possibly get more part of a team than these two are. I guess this it's so interesting to kind of like wonder where this will end up by the end of the story, because obviously like relationships have been such an important part of Avery's story, and she's currently thinking about like moving away, or you know, she is sort of, I think, distancing herself from the unrealistic romantic relationship expectations she had at the start. And I'm so fascinated by the way this bond with Snowdrop has kind of met some of what she wanted. Like it's giving, it's such a monkey's paw version of like what she wanted at the start of the story. Mm. I think we talked about this when they first like really started hanging out, but like Snowdrop gives her that kind of friend who will always have your back, someone you can, and now that they're familiar, someone you can always be in sync with and work on as part of a team with.
Yeah.
But it's not that, like, it doesn't have the romantic angle. And I just wonder how much she sort of explicitly in her head is recognizing, yeah, this idea of, you know, this is giving her so much of what she wants, but it's not having some parts, but does that matter? Because I almost kind of got the impression at the start of the story she wanted what she has with Snowdrop, but also it was meant to be romantic and they were like each other's life partners, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
She wanted them to be defined by each other in a massive way. And with Snowdrop, she's almost had to push against that. Like, she doesn't want Snowdrop defined by her.
Yeah, you're right. Almost a perfect relationship for her to have, because it's made her question the idea of like building my whole identity around a core central relationship is actually bad, and I don't want to be someone that kind of forces my personality onto somebody or has them force their personality onto me. You're right that it's almost the exact prescription that she needs.
Yeah, and I'm almost just waiting for that moment where this becomes explicit in her head of like, oh shit, what I was after was stupid and unreasonable, and like what I've got is actually so much healthier and better.
Yeah.
Like Snowdrop as just her best friend, like the girl Olivia couldn't be, is just so much better for both of them.
Mm.
The other thing this actually brings up is like Avery obviously goes from thinking, oh, this is so cool being a part of a team, not just with Snowdrop, but with the trio. And we get the thing that's become a bit of a gimme for all the Avery chapters for the last like 8 weeks, which is her thinking, oh, I love these guys. I'm so sad I'm going to have to leave them.
Mm.
And I can't believe we haven't asked this already, but where's Snowdrop fit into the whole thing of Avery just bailing on Kennet? Like,
yeah, it's a good point. Presumably Snowdrop will go with Avery. Have they had that conversation?
I don't know. I have to go look now. Like I should have looked this up before we sat down to record, but like I feel like Avery's told Snowdrop she wants to leave, but I'm struggling to remember a thing of like, yeah, because like I mean all of Snowdrop's friends are here. She's got a job offer here. Like I can't see Snowdrop going with her, but then also I can't see Avery going without her. So I don't know. This feels like this must have been addressed already and we've just both forgot, because this is like, how has it not come up, like how Snowdrop fits into Avery just bailing on the town?
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question that you're right. I can't believe we haven't thought of it up until now.
I have a vague memory, and now I'm wondering if I've made it up, but like, I feel like I remember Avery doing, telling Snowdrop, like, oh, I think I have to leave. And Snowdrop being like, you know, like classic Snowdrop, like, yeah, oh, I have your back, like, I'll come with you sort of thing. And then I think that was just the end of it. Whereas, like, there probably needed to be that thought of, is that really what's best for you, Snowdrop, or are you doing the full Avery and just like, like chasing this friend, this one friendship at the risk of all the others?
Yeah. I don't know. We'll have to see if they have that conversation, I guess. Do you think it would be better for Snowdrop to go with Avery or to stay in Kennet?
No, like, she's like, she's got such a good, like, Snowdrop's in a really good place in Kennet. She's got Cherry Pop. She's got like the other goblins. As I said, she's got the job offer from Toadslow. Like, I think she's really at home here. And yeah, I don't, yeah, like, I would think it would be better for Snowdrop to stay. But I mean, just the familiar bond, I guess Durashay was away from her familiar for long periods of time. So I guess, like, you know, maybe this is the way a part of Avery literally stays in Kennet, is through Snowdrop. I don't know. I'm more worried about the idea of Avery going somewhere without Snowdrop, like, because her going somewhere to sort of essentially be on her own, like, the only friend she's going to have when she first gets there is Sheridan. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like a conversation that needs to be had, is my answer to what should happen.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to see.
I mean, like, what do you think?
I just don't know. I mean, like, the fact that they're they've got the familiar relationship to me implies there's at least some practice shenanigans that will make that question not one that can be really easily answered. Like, yes, Snowdrop has some really good connections here in Kennet, but if she doesn't go with Avery, something weird might happen that would sour it for both of them. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see.
Anywho, Cleo arrives here and Avery attempts to talk to her before being drawn into a fight for her life.
I was so caught off guard by the part where Cleo just lied to her about not wanting to kill her. Like, I mean, you know, we've obviously been, we know it's been established that witch hunters don't have to tell the truth, but I'm almost getting used to people who can lie doing it less. Like, just in their own interlude, just last chapter, the witch hunters were so genuine the whole time. I kind of forgot that they can just lie. And so obviously, like, it was very nice of Wildbo to remind us of this so early on with just hitting us with, yeah, like a straight up lie. So the sort of deception I'm not used to seeing in this story.
Yeah. Isn't it good? Oh, man. Cleo's, God, it's so wild as well, because obviously it's so perfect that Avery is the one that she does this to, because it's Avery and it works so perfectly. But like, the thing that really hit me about this on my second read through is the only reason Cleo does this, it must be the only reason, is because this has worked on practitioners before. She has said to other practitioners, hey, let's chat and we can figure this out. They have come to the table and she has used that opportunity to murder them. So not only is Cleo a psychopath, but she's one that has like explicit experience of murdering practitioners who have wanted to try and find amicable ways to solve their problems. And maybe this is like, those practitioners were shady and were going to, you know, weasel their way out of things and whatever. Maybe that's some of them. But, like, it implies to me that Cleo has murdered possibly the good practitioners, who are the ones that we would want the world to be filled with, the ones that can come to reasonable solutions and kind of negotiate and all that stuff that we want. So, I don't know, it's just kind of wild to me to realize, oh, Cleo's probably murdered some nice practitioners that we would really want to exist in this world.
Yeah, because Montreal's obviously quite far away from where this story is, and you get the impression that it's like the lighthouse covers a lot of the same area that, you know, the judges and the practitioners we've met do, and so she's kind of this outsider. And it certainly paints this picture of Montreal being a lot more brutal and like bloody, because she's kind of flipped it and she's using negotiation as a weapon against practitioners, which I don't know, maybe that's fair. Like, I it's so interesting, she makes the lighthouse look better in comparison. Like, you know, all the witch hunters we've seen from the lighthouse have been pretty brutal, but I'd pick any of them over Cleo, I think.
She's rough. She's a real serial killer, basically.
Yeah. Well, and wait, that's the other thing about her is, like, she's just a big hypocrite. Like, she talks about, like, well, so first of all, she's got a collection of magical tools. And there's one point where she's talking about, like, the camera, and she's like, yeah, I had to, like, clean it out of the curse. And it's like, that sounds like practice shit to me. Like, she's getting these, like, cursed objects, fucking cleaning them out, turning them into, like, magical weapons. Like, that, that's collector 101. Like, that's how you start being a collector. And yeah, she's collecting fingers, and some of them still bleed because she's keeping the people alive. Like, way to fucking undermine everything you claim to stand for. Like, it's just outrageous how much she's like, yeah, just gathering trophies and magical objects and using them, and then being like, yeah, I have to stop people who use dark magic. Like, what?
Yeah. It's crazy. She seems like she's so far gone from any reason.
Yeah.
Dark, like, what the fuck? Dark magic, what are you talking about? Yeah. Yeah. That's a line that feels like it's just in there to aggravate the people like Avery who would try to talk to her, to negotiate with her.
Especially coming from the woman wearing a necklace of fingers she took from people.
Like, how just low self-awareness can you have?
Also, just quick shout out. Like, obviously, I did go looking to see if Cleo showed up in Mile End because she's from Montreal. I didn't see anything. Maybe she was in a future thing before that got canceled.
Interesting.
Yeah, I guess obviously we talked about Mile End, you know, months ago, and I guess, you know, based on the snippet of Montreal that we saw from there, I don't know when exactly Mile End is meant to take place, but I guess based on how Mile End was going, it could have become a pretty violent and cutthroat area.
God, Cleo is just wild. So she almost, this fingers thing.
Yeah.
She almost catches and takes a finger from Raquel here before John saves her, and then Cleo shoots John in the head, and it's just crazy. Like, yeah, again, how little self-awareness can you have wearing a necklace of fingers that you've stolen from people that you've killed?
I also want to just give Raquel another shout out for being, like, feeling like a bit of a lost cause. Because, like, Avery goes out of her way to try and help Raquel, but obviously Raquel doesn't really get to see any of this. And there's the best, like, there's the bit where after they've shot her and there's a moment between, and Avery's like, oh, Raquel, like, are you okay? And Raquel's just like, fuck off, like, you probably led her right to me. And it's just like, oh, like, Raquel, I'm trying so hard to be on your side, but fuck, you make it difficult. Like, I guess I can see why Raquel missed all the stuff, but Avery has just done her such a massive favor, and she just spits in her face.
It's frustrating. You feel the frustration through Avery's perspective here, right? Yeah.
Hey, maybe that's that Kennet thing again. You know, Avery was trying to be nice to the other team and be peaceful with them, and she's being punished for it because Raquel is instinctively against it.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep beating this drum until it's either confirmed or denied.
Yeah. So, yeah, the bit where John gets shot in the head as well is just like, fuck. Like, there's that moment between seeing John get shot in the head and freaking out and realizing that John can recover from that, where you panic for a brief moment. And obviously, worth calling out, Cleo didn't know he was immortal, so clearly has no qualms about just shooting people in the head. Yes, he was. I mean, he's not, like, obviously a... Yeah,
to
well,
be fair,
that's
he,
fair.
He started it.
He did. Well, he didn't start it, but he started the shooting. Yeah. But yeah, just like, boop, shoot someone in the head. That's fun. Yeah, rough.
Yeah, well, and like, especially I think the reason you get really nervous when he first gets shot is because the last time we saw a witch hunter with a gun, it was Raph, and that bullet, like, actually kind of took John out. Like, if they hadn't scooped those bullets out of him, I get the impression he might have actually been able to die from them.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, been permanently, you know, not working.
Mm.
So, yeah, you're right. It definitely sort of raises the stakes as well. And because Avery's brought him in as the fucking heavy weaponry, and then he just gets taken out. She's left in this parking lot covered in his blood. with Cleo coming back.
Mm. Yeah. God, this, yeah, yeah. I'm really off put by Cleo. I don't know what to do about it. Like, she's on the team of the people that I want them to talk to and befriend and negotiate with, and I just know that's not going to happen because she's going to get in the way of that.
Yeah, but she's not quiet on their team. Like, yeah, I wonder if context of what Montreal is like will help in them sort of wedging a gap between her or being like, you don't want to be like her or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, so Avery is in trouble and is attempting to flee before she gets help. Bria's here and her kids are hungry. Cleo's almost eaten by these children before Cleo quickly makes an escape. And Avery and the gang have been victorious here.
Sort of. I'd call it a draw.
Well, they scared her off before she could scare them off. I think that's a victory.
That's true. Although they were the ones trying to run away. Like, they would have run away if they could have.
Mm.
Yeah, I also want to call it, like, so Avery does a like a bit of a Verona move here and adapts the gate to use Lucy's like super hearing, which again is just like cool. Like the Kenneteers are finding a bunch of really cool uses for their powers in this conflict. Avery worries about how much it's costing, but like what, you know, in a chapter that kind of is focusing a bit on the idea of teamwork, what better way to kind of emblemize that than just like allowing Avery to straight up borrow Lucy's big strength.
Mm.
And like we've seen Verona borrow Snowdrop's stuff through the familiar bond as well. Like it's great. The more powers they're gathering as a group, the more they're also able to trade them. Like that's fucking fantastic.
Yeah. It is very cool. I like the versatility that they have. They're going to need it against the Witch Hunters, which are effectively each Witch Hunter, similar to when they were fighting the Aware, is basically their own trick that they get to employ in some really cool creative ways. So I think it's going to be really fun seeing these conflicts and seeing these Witch Hunters who are, you know, have their own tricks that define the way they fight versus our Kenneteers who have a bag of tricks and have to learn some cool and innovative ways to use them to stay ahead.
Yeah, and obviously, like, Musa and his team, we've talked a lot about how versatility is the name of their game, too. Like, oh, this is such a stacked deck. Like, this finale, it's just going to get wild, right? Like, we don't know what Musa can do. We're starting to get an idea of what the Witch Hunters have up their sleeves, but I'm sure they've got items and shit we haven't seen yet.
Mm.
There's so many pieces on the Kennet board, I can't even remember them all. Plus, Marissica is apparently going to show up and start fucking with those.
Mm.
Plus, there were, like, the fairy-adjacent animals that have been brought up that maybe have something to do with Francis as well as Marissica. Like, oh, like, God, it's just... like, there's so many pieces on this fucking chessboard. I can't possibly predict where shit's going to go because it's just... there's so much hay in this haystack.
Yeah. Again, it is going to be a shit show, right? Like Cleo, as an example, she's able to keep pace with Avery and John pretty easily. She had effectively won that battle before Bree showed up to save the day. And that's just one of the Witch Hunters. There's obviously like six or seven of them and the Musses. Like, yeah, things are going to get messy.
Yeah, it's just like every time I try to think to myself about how messy it's going to get, I suddenly remember some whole other angle to the conflict that I'd forgotten about, like something like the fairy animals or like the possibility that the wolf is maybe going to be involved just from how it's been in the story. Like it just, fuck knows what. Just every time I start to think, oh, this is going to be a mess, I think of a whole new other angle it could be a mess through.
Mm-hmm.
Like what a setup for the sort of finale or climax of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. Going to be exciting. Going to be some exciting stuff. Interestingly, that was my thought as I was finishing up the chapter, but that's not what Avery is thinking about when the chapter finishes up. The chapter ends on a note of Avery thinking about the new Kennet others and how exactly, like, the goblins and the new Kennet others might be playing into the conspiracy, right? We have this idea that each of the new Kennet others was selected for some role to play in the conspiracy that's going on. And that's how the chapter wraps up. And I think it's really interesting because it's Avery / Wabo thinking about how as this war breaks out, you know, the Witch Hunters and the Musses are not the only thing to worry about. The the allies that we have on our side to deal with this shit show are potentially not allies. And there might be a critical moment where some perceived ally fails to deliver their support and things go pear-shaped.
Well, yeah, like I feel like this being the ending to the chapter, like what Wild Bo lets us, leaves us sitting on for like 4 days, is designed to put us in that headspace that we were just talking about, where there's so much shit on this chessboard. Like, you're right. There's all the shit that goes on with Cleo, and instead the chapter ends on the thought, hey, yeah, shit, we've got to watch out for all the new Ken and others for when Marisica comes back, which is apparently going to happen during this conflict. Like Rook thought, like, yeah, it feels like this ending is just designed to make you take that step back and think, fuck, there is so much that can go wrong or right here. Like, there are so many pieces in play.
Yeah. A lot of stuff popping off. But that's the end of the chapters, I suppose, and that's nearly the end of our episode. Before we wrap up, a reminder that we are currently running a discussion question. The discussion question is, how much does Charles have to atone for, and what should his punishment look like? And you can leave your responses to that discussion question in the show notes. In the discussion thread, which will be linked in the show notes down below.
Yep. Don't forget that we're also on Twitter. There probably won't be any live reads again this week. I'm sorry, everyone. You know, that's still where we post updates on the episodes. And if I manage to find a way to do the live reads, then that's where they'll be.
Yeah. As we mentioned at the top of the show, you can also head to doofmedia.com, the Doof Media website, for more information on the Pale Conflections fan art contest on Siblings, which is ending in just under a week as of recording, or as of release, I guess. So make sure you head over there to find out all the details on that, as well as all the details on all the other shows on the Doof Media Network.
Yes. And if you want to be a voter when that fan art contest wraps up, head on over to patreon.com/doofmedia. It's our patrons who will decide which of the entries win. We already have a couple of entries and they're very good. So I'm excited to see what else we can get in the meantime, but, it should be a fun vote, hopefully.
Yeah.
So if you want to be a part of it, head on over to patreon.com/doofmedia.
And while you're on Patreon, make sure you check out Wildbo's Patreon as well at patreon.com/Wildbo, because he's the one who creates all these amazing worlds and fills them with morally gray characters that we get to find out the backstories to. So if you want more of that, and obviously you should, go and support Wildbo on his Patreon.
And with that, we'll see you next week for more Arc 12.
Bye.
Shit's popping off.